This is Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Marty's got the day off today. Smartphones, it seems, accompany us everywhere, to work, school, the theater, the kitchen, the bedroom, the bathroom, you name it. They can bring information, communication, and a sense of fun to life. In short, a lot of what human companionship can offer. But digital devices, of course, aren't human. And researchers have found that too much use can lead to very real negative effects on the brain and mental health. Catherine Price is a health and science journalist and the author of How to Break Up with Your Phone, which includes chapters entitled Your Phone Messes with Your Memory and Our Phones Are Designed to Addict Us. We'll talk about all that and much more. But first, Catherine, welcome back to Radio Times.
Thanks very much for having me.
And let me take just a moment to give the number out. If you'd like to join the conversation, it's 888-477-9499. The email is radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. So we're going to talk about the smartphone in just a sec, but you were listening to the conversation with Tiffany Lee about Facebook, and you had some interesting points to make. So let's get into that first.
Yeah, I think the Cambridge Analytica thing is fascinating for many reasons. I'm like all fired up about it this morning. But one of the things that immediately comes to mind is the irony of all this talk by Mark Zuckerberg and Facebook about the importance of protecting our data. And we, the users, you know, it's responsible for us. I mean, Facebook's entire business model is to be a surveillance state, basically, and collect as much data on us as possible, and then to make money off of selling that data. So to me, the real scandal here is not that someone made money or potentially swayed an election based on very detailed data on each of our lives. It's that Facebook didn't make money off of this transaction. So I just, you know, I listen to these statements and I just laugh a little bit because we are not actually who Facebook cares about. Facebook cares about its advertisers because that is how it makes its money.
But when we're on Facebook, when we're using Facebook and posting pictures and communicating with family and friends, I'm going to jump, make a leap here and say most of us aren't thinking about that, that Facebook's there to make money.
I think most of us haven't been thinking about that, but I think that as a result of scandals like this, an increasing number of us are beginning to think about this. And I would add to that, increasing awareness about what Facebook is doing on Facebook's site. Facebook leaves cookies behind, small files that can follow you around the internet, so that Facebook actually knows what you do on the rest of the internet too. Anytime you see a Facebook like button on a page, I mean, Facebook knows exactly what you're doing there, what links you're clicking on, what you're looking at. And it also buys data from external data collection firms such as Experian, as in the one that just had a non-arguable huge data breach later last year. Yeah. And they tie together our online lives with our offline lives, including the loans that we have, what type of cars we've bought, basically any purchase you've ever made with a credit card. I mean, it would be fascinating and terrifying to get a sense of how much data is actually out there on each of us. And what's more, how accurate that data is, because they make assumptions off of it. That's where the real money lies, is making assumptions off the data to target ads to us. And ProPublica, an investigative journalism nonprofit, actually did a project where they created a plugin that you can download on your Facebook page. If you Google ProPublica and privacy and Facebook, it will come up. And it basically pulls together all the privacy settings from Facebook on one easy to digest page. And you can actually see what kind of projections are being made about you based on what Facebook knows about you. And you can revoke some of the permissions, although, I mean, plenty of people have used it already. But it's very, very interesting and disturbing. So yeah. I really think
it is
people,
scary.
Yes, we need to be a lot more thoughtful about the fact that Facebook's homepage says it's free and always will be. The company was recently valued at $500 billion. You do not get that valuation by giving away your product for free.
Nothing in life is free.
Exactly.
Yeah. So we'll get to some more social media in a moment, but let's get to the smartphone. First of all, to be clear, you've written this book, How to Break Up with Your Phone. You've changed your relationship with your phone. You haven't entirely given it up, right?
Yes. Yeah, so breaking up with your phone, I really like to clarify this to people. It's not about dumping your phone. It's not about throwing it under a bus or into the river or something like that. It's creating a healthier relationship with it. So right now, a lot of us are in this kind of obsessive romantic relationship where we crave our smartphones. We think about them all the time. We sleep with them, right? What I'm suggesting that people do is take a step back and become friends with your smartphone. It's a very useful tool. It has many, many useful features. But the way we're using it right now is not that healthy.
Tell us about, I read there was a watershed moment for you in which you decided you had to put some distance between you and your phone, and it involved Your baby.
Yeah, I had a baby about 2.5 years ago, actually right when I came on Radio Times the last time. And I remember one night when I saw her looking up at me in this darkened room, and I was looking down on my phone. And
what were you looking for?
It was not Facebook. I actually was on eBay searching for antique doorknobs, which perhaps is weirder, and I don't even want to know what eBay projects about me based on its user data. But anyway, I thought to myself, this is not what I want my daughter's first impression of a human relationship to be. And there's lots of scientific data backing up that this is a valid concern. There's a series of experiments called the still face experiments where babies are put in a room, usually with the mother. I don't think the fathers were involved. And the mother interacts with them normally for a couple of minutes and then goes totally stone-faced and does not interact with the baby. Mm-hmm. And you can see there are videos of this online. The babies start to basically freak out. It's a very strong psychological effect to have their caregiver not respond in the way that they're evolutionarily programmed to expect us to respond. And what I came to realize is that that's exactly what I was doing to my daughter. And that what's more, that's what many of us are doing to the adults in our lives as well. We're in a society-wide still face experiment, and we don't know the ramifications of it yet.
Do you have any sense, or I'm sure you do have a sense, of how much time the average person spends on his or her phone?
Funny you should ask that. Yes, I have data from a user. It's a time tracking app called Moment that I highly recommend. It has about 4.8 million users on this app, and the average person is spending 3 hours and 57 minutes per day, as in almost 4 hours a day, on their phones, which is a quarter of our waking lives. And what's more, it's not time when you're talking on the phone or listening to music. It is time when the screen is on. So in reality, we're probably using it for more than that.
Let's talk about how this smartphone was designed to work. Tell us about brain hacking and dopamine.
Brain hacking and dopamine. Okay, so dopamine is a chemical which basically tells us, it's our brain's way of learning when something is worth doing again. You do something and it's enjoyable, pleasurable, or in some way rewarding. Dopamine's released and you want to do it again.
It's like Pavlov's dog.
Yes. Yeah. Well, yes. Well, that's more anticipation and cravings, but yes. So basically, two of the main situations in which dopamine is released would be food and sex. That's the easiest examples of it. But it's also released when we check our phones, because one of the main triggers for dopamine to be released is novelty. If you think about your phone, every time you look at your phone, you're going to see something new. This means every time you look at your phone, you will have a bit of dopamine released. What's more, when you add in the notifications, the audible indicators or visual, like the little bubbles, indicator that there's something new, you start to release dopamine in anticipation of that reward. And that's when we become like Pavlov's dogs. We basically are salivating every time we get close to our smartphones. It's gotten to the point we don't even have to have a notification. Just the sight of it makes you want to pick it up.
And this fosters dependence, you're saying?
It fosters dependence and a cycle in which the more you check your phone, the more that circuit is reinforced and the more you want to check your phone again and spend more time on it.
And smartphone engineers know this as they're designing the device?
There are all sorts of design elements on the phones, and more specifically apps that are designed to trigger dopamine to get us coming back to use the app as much as possible. And I do like to distinguish between the app makers and the phone makers, because the phone makers want us to buy their phones. Once you spend $1,000 on an iPhone X, like Apple's made most of its money from that iteration, right? App makers, on the other hand, are selling our attention, as we've been talking about. They make money based on the amount of time we spend on the app. So while phone makers most certainly are building in dopamine triggers to the design of their phones, because that's what makes them fun and what makes us keep using the phones, app makers, and particularly social media app makers, are even more interested in getting this dopamine system engaged. And once you realize that, you start to see triggers all over the design of the apps. What I suggest that people do is to start to consciously think to themselves about similarities between the apps they're using and slot machines, because they're very similar, right down to the act of pulling down to refresh your feed, just like pulling a slot machine's lever. If you think about how it takes a second for it to load and you feel kind of twitchy to see what's going to happen, exactly the same as waiting to see whether or not your cherries are going to line up or whatever on the slot machine. If you think about a casino in general that doesn't have any clocks in it and it doesn't have any windows, well, that's meant to give you no sense of time, so you sit in that seat for as long as possible. Likewise, news feeds on social media apps never end. Facebook never ends. Twitter never ends. Yeah. And that is a deliberate design choice designed to keep you in your seat or staring at that screen for as long as possible.
It's really easy to lose track of time.
Exactly.
On these sites. Interestingly, you also remind us that Steve Jobs, who introduced the iPhone, restricted his own kids' access to it.
Yes, he's famously quoted in a New York Times piece from a while ago about not giving his kids access to the iPad. And people who had been at the Jobs' house for dinner said that they were most definitely not keeping their technologies on the table with them. They were having engaged human conversations. And he's not the only one of these tech insiders to do this. There's an increasing number of tech insiders speaking out against the very products they helped to create and saying things like, I wouldn't give my children access to Facebook or social media. I mean, Sean Parker, the first president of Facebook, said, you know, God only knows what it's doing to our children's brains. That was a direct quote from him last fall.
So let's focus more fully on kids. According to Common Sense Media, most teens have their own smartphones or access to one. Before we get to the negatives, Catherine, there are some positives. You know, when it comes to teens and smartphone use, it can encourage communication with friends. Are there any positives? I'm looking at your face right now.
She's looking at me expectantly like, give me something good.
Is there anything good?
I mean, I was just thinking, I guess, yeah, it's communicate, but like what kind of communication?
Yeah.
Like to, when I talk about phones and kids, I like to take a step back and encourage all of us to ask two things. The first of which is basically when you give your kid a phone, like what is the point? What are you trying to get out of it? And what kind of communication are you trying to make sure that they're able to participate in?
So, well, it seems like there are two reasons. The parent who wants to be in touch with the child, you know, soccer practice, whatever's happening at school, keeping in touch, making sure the child is safe. And also because everybody else has one and the kid, there's FOMO, FOMO, how it's pronounced, fear of your child missing out.
Fear of your child missing out. Well, this gets to the second point, to remember that we are the adults.
Yeah.
In two senses. One is that we can't expect our children to not want phones or to not be on their phones all the time if we ourselves are constantly on our phones. I think we forget that. But second, it's up to us to have responsible conversations with our children about the pros and cons of smartphones. Because, I mean, as you were suggesting, there are pros and cons to smartphones. And to come at this issue as a family and figure out what responsible use looks like to you as a family. There's a woman named Anya Kamenetz who wrote a great book called The Art of Screen Time, which was published recently about kids and phones in particular. And she uses the analogy of smartphones being like cars. Eventually, your kid's going to get a car because to be a functional member of society, you need to learn how to drive at some point. And granted, I'm from New York and basically still can't drive very well, so be that as it may. But anyway, but you're not just going to hand your 10-year-old a set of car keys. The average kid these days is getting their first smartphone at the age of 10, right? You would have a driver's ed. You would have conversations about safety. You'd learn how to use a seatbelt. You'd learn about the dangers of texting and driving, right? You do all of these things.
Sure.
And I think that that is how we should be approaching the question of when to give our kids smartphones and how they should be used. It should be a family media plan. And Common Sense Media actually provides some resources on its website for how to develop such a thing.
Smartphones can generate anxiety. That's clear. Let's get into this a little bit. I love this line from your book. Not only do smartphones make it easy to find out about the things we're missing, but also through notifications, they spray FOMO at us like a sneeze.
Yeah, that seems even more appropriate now since it's been such a sick season recently. Mm-hmm. But yes, I mean, I think about my smartphone as being a Pandora's box of emotions. And I think that's a helpful image to have in mind. Because if you think about it, first of all, you're seeking out your smartphone because you want to find something that will trigger an emotion there. And normally we hope it's something happy. But if you think in reality about like what you find when you're waiting there, what percentage of the time do you check your phone and find something you're like, yay, you know, like earlier today, I saw a news headline about a man dressed as Chewbacca going into a kid's hospital room to announce the child had received a heart for a transplant. That's a yay moment. I have not seen that news story ever. You know, 99% of the time, it's something depressing or upsetting or anxiety provoking. And I think that's useful to keep in mind because it gives you a chance to pause for a moment and ask yourself if you actually want to let those emotions into your life right now, right? Like, do you want to open that door? You don't have to. You can decide not to check the phone right there. And you could decide, sure, it's fine, and end up checking the phone anyway. But the point is that it then would be a conscious decision and you're aware of the potential consequences.
It's all about deciding where you want to focus your attention.
Exactly. I mean, this really, it all comes down to attention. As I like to say, we only experience and remember what we pay attention to. Our lives are what we pay attention to. And so when you decide to spend your attention on something in the moment, you're making a broader decision about how you want to spend your life.
We don't like to be bored, do we?
We don't like to be bored. And there's no judgment in any of this. If you want to check your phone and you want to spend your 5 minutes of your time on the lunch line checking your phone, that's no one's business but your own.
Sure.
Right? But right now, up to now, I would say most of us actually haven't really thought about that, because smartphones have really come into our lives so quickly and permeated society so thoroughly that we just haven't really thought about them before.
Downtime and boredom, not necessarily one and the same, although sometimes we think it is. If we don't have that downtime, if we don't walk away from something that grabs our attention constantly, what does that do to creativity?
I think it does a lot to creativity and a lot to our brains. If you think about creativity, which obviously is a mysterious thing, but I think that most people would agree that you need to have some space in your brain in order to have a creative thought. If you're scrolling through Twitter or answering emails while you're trying to look through Twitter, there's just not enough space in your brain to actually have an insight, which of course is like the base of creativity. And there is scientific explanation for this, which has to do with memory and how our memories are formed in our brains. So traditionally, people describe long-term memories as being like stuffed away in file cabinets, which is a convenient way of applying something we know very well to the mystery that is our brain. But it seems that that is not at all the case. And in fact, long-term memories exist in what are called schemi, which are networks of connected things, where you can have two things that are connected by one characteristic that are then connected to other things with different characteristics that aren't let me give an example. Like a traffic cone is orange and an orange is orange. So they're connected by the color orange. Mm-hmm. Orange is also a citrus fruit, so it's connected to a lemon, but the lemon's not connected to the traffic cone. They exist in different schemi. So if you get what I'm saying, like everything we experience in our lives has potential connections to all sorts of other things.
So how does the smartphone disrupt that process?
So it takes time and it takes a distraction, free time more specifically, for our brain to make these connections between disparate things, for our brains to process what we experience. That's the issue. We have no time to process, means we cannot create these connections, which means that you don't have the opportunity to come up with connections between seemingly disparate and unconnected things, which is what an insight is, because you've never made those connections in the first place.
So and it can affect memory, creativity, attention. We'll get into more of that after the break, but I'm curious, you did do a detox and you are still with your phone. You didn't entirely, leave it on the road to be run over by a truck. How much time do you allow yourself per day how do you structure your day as far as your phone is concerned? What's your routine like?
Well, first I call it more couples therapy than a detox, but it depends on the day. And I think that this is an important point, that there's not just so my plan in my book is a 30-day plan, and I could talk about why it's that long later if you'd like to,
sure.
But basically, it's an ongoing process, and I don't say to myself, you only get 1 hour of phone time a day, because that's restrictive. Basically, what I try to do is that anytime I reach for my phone, I ask myself, do I want to be reaching for my phone right now? What am I trying to accomplish? And is there something else I could do? I call that what for, why now, and what else, WWW. And once you get into that habit, it takes the judgment out of it. It's no longer like, oh, you screwed up. You spent way too much time. If I spend too much time and I feel bad about it, I say, okay, I spent too much time. I feel bad about it. What am I going to do next time?
All right. More to come in the next segment of Radio Times. Catherine Price is the author of How to Break Up with Your Phone. We're talking about smartphone technology, why it can be so addictive. And we'll talk about simple ways to reduce our dependence on it. Stay with us for more of Radio Times. You're listening to WHYY in Philadelphia. This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in today for Marty Moskowain. Catherine Price is in studio with us. Her new book is How to Break Up with Your Phone. We are talking about smartphones for this part of the hour. And, if you're not sure of your relationship with your phone, if you've got questions about how your kids, if you have children, might relate to their phones, here's the number, 888-477-9499. You can also send us an email at radiotimes@whyy.org or tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes. So, Catherine, in your book, you wrote an open letter to your phone. If you could read a little bit of that for us.
Sure. This is an open letter to my phone. It's the introduction to the book, and it begins, "Dear phone, I still remember the first time we met. You were an expensive new gadget available only through AT&T. I was a person who could recite her best friend's phone numbers from memory. When you were launched, I'll admit that your touchscreen caught my eye, but I was too busy trying to type a text message on my flip phone to start something new. Then I held you in my hand and things started moving fast. It wasn't long before we were doing everything together, taking walks, having lunch with friends, going on vacations. At first it seemed strange that you wanted to come with me to the bathroom, but today it's just a formerly private moment for us to share. We're inseparable now, you and I, You're the last thing I touch before I go to bed and the first thing I reach for in the morning.
Oh, it sounds like a love letter, doesn't it?
It was weird because it was strange how easy it was to write because it felt so natural. You know, it was like, oh, this is all so true.
Yeah. Let's talk some more about children. You know, you mentioned flip phones. The advice is for young children, perhaps, to start with a flip phone as opposed to a smartphone. What do you think about that?
I think it's a great idea. And it again comes back to the question of why are you getting your kid a smartphone? Mm-hmm. What's the purpose? And I really mean to ask yourself that question, because in many cases, it's just what you were saying. It's to make sure they're okay at soccer practice. It's so that I know they are at soccer practice. It's so that they can call me when they get home. Well, that can be achieved by a flip phone. And then if you also look up GPS smartwatches or smart devices, there are devices out there that are available that just have the capability to call a few people, text, and have a GPS sensor in it. And so then it's like, okay, well, you satisfied that need. Do you really want your kid to have access to the entire internet at all times in their pocket?
I always thought it was like having the world in your pocket.
Exactly. But it's like the worst of the world in your pocket.
Yeah. You know, the good and the bad and the ugly.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. What are some apps that parents can use if they do decide to go with the smartphone for a younger child? Do you know of anything?
Oh, I mean, I don't really... A lot of people want to track everything their kid does on their phones. And I guess I think that that's like that's not really addressing the issue, which again is that we should be talking about this. Who wants to be surveilled? Facebook surveilling us already. No kid wants their parents to read their diary. And that's kind of what you're doing. So I would say first that we need to have a conversation about which apps are going to be installed, which ones aren't, why they aren't. I mean, really, like, we should be talking about this, I would say, is the first step.
Let's talk about a rule of thumb for usage for older kids. In the journal Emotion, which studied high school students, it found that too much time on their devices, surprise, surprise, is linked to lower self-esteem and a decrease in well-being. Teens who spend 5 or more hours a day online are twice as likely to say they're unhappy. The other end, digital abstinence, a teen feels shut out, can tend to feel shut out. So the sweet spot seems to be maybe an hour a day for teenagers. This is when teens who are on an hour a day seem to feel the happiest. What do you think about that? And again, we're talking about regulation here.
I think those are kind of silly studies, honestly.
Do you?
Yeah, it's kind of like, I'm tired of hearing those studies. It's like, okay, so people ask me, what's the perfect amount a day? 1 hour a day? I'm like, how am I supposed to tell? You need to ask yourself, how do you feel when you're on Facebook? Yeah. Right? I don't think personally, I don't feel ever good when I'm on Facebook or social media. It never makes me feel good.
Why? When you see pictures of your family and people...
Well,
you know,
my family is really small, so it's not like that many pictures, but it's not actually connecting with them. I think it's so funny and ironic and silly of Mark Zuckerberg to talk about making Facebook about more meaningful interactions where there's really no such thing. But I think the big thing I want to get across is that a lot of times we talk about tips and tricks and we're looking for these micro solutions. My book is about a broader plan. It's a broader system and set of exercises designed to take a step back and help you figure out what you want your life to be like, and then to figure out how your phone should fit into that. Not about how many minutes per day is or is not going to make you feel good on Instagram. It's about, like, what do you want to be spending your time on?
And mindful about where you want to put your attention.
Yeah, and then how do you restructure your life and add triggers and remove triggers so that you have a healthy relationship with your phone, so that it serves as a useful tool. Because it is, again, a truly useful tool and an amazing device, but it does not get in the way with your true desires and true sources of happiness and meaning in life.
Let's get to the phones. Allison in Malvern, Pennsylvania, welcome to Radio Times.
Thank you. Good morning. Here is my concern. I have an 18-year-old, a 15-year-old, and a 10-year-old, and we were reluctant adopters, and so we forced all of our children to get flip phones initially so that they knew how hard it was to text on a flip phone. But of course, we did evolve into iPhones for them. And now my concern, not really my concern, my challenge issue is that this is how that generation communicates. That's the only way that they communicate, through Snapchat and through instant messaging and through even, I believe, in much as I check out their phones, I believe there's other apps and means of communication that they use that I'm not aware of.
Yeah.
When I take their phone away, it's cutting them off completely from their society, and it doesn't really impact the other friends. They're just offline. And also, that's the way I have to get in touch with them during the day. And if they don't have a phone, it's incredibly difficult for me to say, look, you have to be picked up early. So could you, sort of respond to the fact that this is trying to create a background for these kids that doesn't exist.
Thanks, Allison. That's a great point. This is the way most kids communicate these days. Can you really turn the clock back 20 years ago?
Well, we certainly can't turn the clock back 20 years ago. I mean, even adults are obviously using phones to communicate with each other. We're texting a lot more than we're calling people, for example. So I totally hear where you're coming from and understand the challenges you're discussing. I think what I would say is that, again, this gets to the idea that we really need to be having more conversations about this, because if someone doesn't know what communication is like off the phone, and we do know what that's like, even if we're not always practicing it ourselves, then it becomes something we can share with them, something we can talk about, something you can like experiment with. I'm very into experiments as families to say, okay, let's just see what it would be like if we didn't have our phones at the dinner table, or, hey, let's go to dinner and then look around us at the other tables. Let's just notice what people are doing, how many people are on their phones. How do you think that's impacting their interactions? So this is not a quick fix. It's not like this is suddenly going to mean that your kids are spending no time a day on Snapchat. But I think the point is to start to become more aware of our own habits, what really brings us joy, and then how our smartphones are affecting that. And I think that over time, if we keep up these efforts, then the change begins to come from within. Because I know a lot of kids who are able to self-regulate themselves because they recognize they actually don't feel that good when they're doing this stuff. So again, I think it's a very difficult subject and a lot of us are struggling with it. But to me, the first step is awareness and to begin to educate each other about what meaningful communication really is, and then experiment with different ways of achieving it.
Well, perhaps even a conversation with your child, and if you know their friend's parents, everybody kind of talks about it and says, hey, maybe we do 3 hours and we go here, you know, or you guys go here and we put the smartphones down for that amount of time.
Yes. I mean, I created a bunch of resources that are free and it's on the book's website, which is phonebreakup.com, including a 30-day phone breakup challenge people can sign up for that's designed to accompany the book. And I think that it's a great idea to turn this into a family-wide challenge or experiment or even game. And so actually, if there's any kids listening out there who are like, oh my God, my parents are addicted, I can't, well, they shut up because they are the ones who have the problem. There are some apps you can use to track how much time you're both on and off your phone. And you could do this as a family. So Moment will track how much time you're on your phone. Flipped, F-L-I-P-D, is one that tracks how much time you're off your phone. So does Lil Space, L-I-L-S-P-A-C-E. These are all in the book's website, phonebreakup.com. And you can have a game where it's like, okay, well, let's just see who has the problem, right? And track for 24 hours. And you might be very surprised by the results. And it really might spur a much more satisfying conversation about this.
So you're talking about 30 days and not 5 days?
30 days, 30. Not just a tip and trick. Well, the thing is, you can't make any meaningful change just by reading like a list of 5 tips, you know, or just like blocking an app. You need to have a broader context for it. But I do think we all have the power to do this. I mean, this process has really changed my life and the lives of a lot of people who've written to me since then or who participated in the initial development of the plan. And it's been very inspiring as a writer and just as a person to feel that I can help empower people to make a positive change.
So you are more mindful about what you want to do with the phone and what you want to pay attention to in life. So describe how this has changed your life.
Well, first of all, my attention
span. Are you feeling
span.
More peaceful? Are you
yes.
feeling less anxious?
I'm going to sound like a crazy evangelist, but yes, I feel more peaceful. I feel less anxious. When I first wrote about this in my journal, I sounded like I was a person with an attention deficit disorder, because I was. I mean, I've said this, but it's somewhere in the middle of it. I'm talking about phones, and then there's a line that says, I just went on Amazon and bought 3 sports bras. And there's like no mention of sports or bras anywhere in the journal other than that line. And now I'm able to actually read a book, like, without reaching for my phone. I can concentrate on things. It's very nice. If you guys have forgotten what that's like, it's really nice. And I'm able to stand online for lunch and not check my phone and just be bored, which is surprisingly relaxing.
And so it's relaxing to be bored.
It can be very relaxing. It can also be uncomfortable, but in that discomfort, that's where your brain starts hopping around and comes up with creative ideas. And I'd also say that the process of changing my relationship with my phone has forced me to ask myself, what do I want to be spending my time on? As I know I keep saying. And for me, there was a really freaky moment because I realized I didn't really know. I was sitting on my couch, not on my phone. I couldn't figure out what to do with myself. But that, as a result of that, I actually had to answer the question. And I did things like sign up for an adult guitar class, which has led to an adult choir. So it brought music back in my life and I have a new community of people. So I really feel that the process of reevaluating the seemingly mundane element of my life has had much more profound, a much greater and more profound impact than I ever could have predicted. Mm-hmm. And I feel from the feedback I've gotten so far that this has been happening to other people too.
Sometimes I wonder if artists like Da Vinci would have created the Mona Lisa or the Last Supper if they'd had a smartphone next to them.
Exactly. I also wonder
we never know, but you know, you wonder sometimes.
Or like what Benjamin Franklin would have done on Twitter. That I would actually.
I would watch. I'd follow him.
Yeah. I totally follow him.
All right, back to the phones. Bluebell and Lauren, welcome to Radio Times.
Hi, I have a question because I teach college and my students sometimes have a hard time doing their homework because they say, as you said, they have the fear of missing out, so they're always attached to their phone. But they so often tell me they are so anxious and they're so stressed out, and I just hear that over and over. You've touched on it a little bit, but what kind of a plea can I give to my students to help them be able to put down the phone and feel better and actually be able to do their homework?
Quick question for you, Lauren, before Catherine asks this. Have you been teaching long enough so that you've seen students before the advent of the cell phone?
No, not since before the advent of the cell phone, but even just in several years' time, I've seen a switchover of younger students. This has become more of an issue than from students several years ago.
All right, Catherine?
Yeah, well, a couple things come to mind. First is that you touched upon something we were talking about earlier, which is that a lot of times young people are a lot more self-perceptive than we give them credit for. So if your students are actually noticing that they're having trouble focusing on their homework and that it's making them anxious to touch their phones, that's a lot more insight than a lot of older people have around the use of devices. So kudos to your students. But I would suggest maybe trying to see if you could do a classroom experiment with this. I'm very, as you can tell, into experiments, both because I think they're useful, but also because there's no pressure. There's an end to it. So the app I mentioned before, Flipped, FLIPD. It's actually meant for educators, and it you can look into it. But basically, it's an easy way to create a class online that encourages people to switch off at a particular time each day. It could be during your class, or it could be like your class decides on a homework hour where they're not going to be on their phones, and then everyone does it for a week. And then the next week in class, you talk about what it was like. So I think that it's little things like that that kind of encourage us to develop more self-awareness and give us a little tool to counteract some of the anxiety that actually could really be helpful for your students going forward.
Thanks, Lauren, for the call to Radio Times. So, you know, students these days, too, suffice it to say, they're not getting enough rest in general, in part because people tend to take those smartphones to bed with them. There's blue light. There's also, you know, notifications. And address that for us, if you would.
Well, again, not just students.
Yeah.
I've done a lot of surveys of people. And when you ask people, do their phones go to bed with them? Yes, they do. And also then you ask, do you use your phone as an alarm clock? Yes. Well, if your phone's your alarm clock, then you've got to touch your phone first thing in the morning to get the alarm clock to go off. You're going to start using the phone. So solutions to that for both students and adults is, first, get the phone out of the bedroom. Create a charging station for it that is not in your bedroom. You probably heard
that
tip
before. You don't need it for an emergency either.
Yeah, I mean, but even if it's like right across the room and not within arm's reach, right? Yeah. But you've heard that tip before. You probably said, I tried that. It didn't work. My phone was back in my bedroom 2 days later. That's because you didn't replace that bad trigger with a positive trigger. So if you're going to take a phone away, which is how you've been entertaining yourself for a half an hour before bed, you got to figure out what you're going to do instead. So if you are saying to yourself, okay, what do I want to pay attention to? I want to read more. Well, get a book you actually want to read and put it on your bedside table so that when you go to reach for your phone out of instinct and habit, you encounter the book instead. Now you have something to do instead of going and getting that phone. That's how you make behaviors change. That's how you change your habits. You need to replace the trigger with something you actually want to be doing.
And it can be different reading, a traditional print format as opposed to reading on a computer?
Well, that gets into the light thing. Yeah. First of all, if you're on your phone and you're reading, there's an infinite number of distractions, and your brain is constantly having to say no to those distractions, even if you're not consciously aware that you're doing it. And that's one of the reasons it feels so different to read on your phone or your computer from an actual print book or even an ebook. But the other thing is the blue light, as you're talking about. You're basically giving yourself jet lag if you are looking at a screen before bedtime. And to a certain degree, that's true even if you have the night mode features enabled. So that's a huge deal. And when you learn about some of the other negative effects associated with screen time, all these stress things, effects on memory, health, whatever, those are also strongly associated, I'd go so far as to say, caused by a lack of sleep as well. So you're doing a double whammy. You've got all the potential negative effects just from the phone, and then you have the impact of the lack of sleep.
Mm. We've got about 10 seconds. Anything you want to leave our listeners with here is in terms of a recommendation to take with them?
I would just encourage you to check out the resources at phonebreakup.com and get in the habit of asking yourself what you want to pay attention to.
Catherine Price, great to have you along for Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
Really informative hour. Catherine Price is a health and science journalist and the author of How to Break Up with Your Phone. And as always, don't forget to visit our Facebook page. Check out our podcasts. You'll find everything at whyy.org/Radio Times. Our engineer today has been Diana Martinez. Our producers, Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nouri. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Thanks for joining us for Radio Times.